everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. It's September 4th. It's a Tuesday in this year of 2012, and we've moved. And it was easy. No sweat or anything. We just changed days. So instead of Wednesdays from 3 to 4, we are now every Tuesday from 4 to 5. And I am really honored to be in this part of the schedule following Dr. Helen Caldicott. She is really an amazing individual, and it's really quite an honor to follow her today. I'm going to be looking forward to listening to her show just before I start mine. Okay, so I'm Karen Hartglass, and I have a nonprofit called Responsible Eating and Living, which you can find at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I know it's a mouthful, but it's a delicious one, believe me. Just go there and visit. There's lots of wonderful videos and recipes, and you can find the archives to this show. Lots of information there. And if you want to send me a message, comments, questions, my email is, are you ready? info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. And if for some reason you're inspired during this hour and you absolutely have to ask us something right away, you can call at 1-888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Very good. And before I bring on my first guest, I wanted to talk about one of last week's guests, which was Zell Allen, and she was talking about her cookbook, Vegan for the Holidays. And it's a little early to be talking about Christmas and Kwanzaa and Hanukkah, but it got me thinking about Hanukkah in particular, because one of the things that drives me crazy, I love holidays and I love traditional foods, but one of the traditional foods for Hanukkah is the potato pancake, the potato latke. And the holiday is all about celebrating this mist, this magical oil that was used in a lamp and it lasted for 8 days instead of one day. And as a result, the tradition is we celebrate the oil by eating lots of it, and especially potatoes fried in lots of it. And it's really rough eating all of these oil-laden potatoes. And yet I like to keep the tradition going, and so years ago, I came up with a potato pancake recipe that was vegan. It had no eggs in it, but it did use a lot of oil. It's been driving me nutty, and I finally came up with a wonderful recipe. It's potato pancakes, taste great. You can make it with next to no oil or no oil at all, still delicious. So visit responsibleeatingandliving.com and click on the recipes over on the left-hand column, just real recipes or sides. You'll find it. It's great. And I have included lots of variations where you can add kasha to it, buckwheat, spinach, carrot, onions. I'm so excited about this recipe, but I'll be telling you more about that. I'll remind you about it when the holidays come around. It's also a great party food. Okay. I'm excited about food. Can you tell that? Because it's all about food. And there's lots of fun things to talk about when we talk about food. And we're going to jump right in and talk about healthy, delicious food, my favorite subject, with Chef Del Sroof. He has worked for 6 years as chef and co-owner of Wellness Forum Foods, a plant-based meal delivery and catering service that emphasizes healthy, minimally processed foods, produces a line of in-the-bag mixes, and offers cooking classes to the public. He has worked in vegan and vegetarian kitchens for 22 years, including spending time as a vegan personal chef. He lives, works, and cooks in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to It's All About Food, Chef Del.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, well, you know, you're all a part of the Forks Over Knives brand, which is a very exciting thing in the vegan world.
Sure.
So I talked about the video when it came out, and I had Dr. T. Colin Campbell and Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn on, as well as your producer, Brian Wendell.
Brian Wendell, sure.
Yeah. And then we had Gene Stone on the show. He lives in Manhattan here, so it was easy for him to come into the studio. And we talked about the book, Forks Over Knives. And now the natural progression is to have the cookbook. And I want to tell you, I've been carrying around today, and it's heavy.
There's a lot of recipes in there.
This is one heavy book. Over 300 recipes. You know, you could just get a workout, and workouts are important. So it's a good book to carry around.
Right,
and,
right.
And
there
build,
you go.
Build bones. I'm always
a new use if you don't like to cook.
Right. Okay. So before we dive into all the wonderful recipes in this book, you have a story, and I want you to share it with the listeners because people love to hear individual stories. They resonate mostly with them rather than all of the facts and numbers and reasons to eat a certain way. People like to hear individual stories, and you have a good one.
Sure. Well, and I won't go back. Well, I'm going to go back to when I was 8 years old, but I'll skip ahead some, so bear with me. But when I was 8 years old, I was put on my first diet, and it was an 800-calorie restricted diet. It wasn't plant-based or anything like that, but it's significant because of the restricted calories, it set off what I call a career of yo-yo dieting, one where I would gain weight and lose weight, and all using this restricted calorie method, assuming that it was the way to do it. In 1997, I opened a vegan bakery, became vegan, and spent the next 4 years not only trying to grow my business, but gaining over 200 pounds myself on a vegan diet.
Can we just stop there for a minute? Why did why did you become vegan?
I had worked the 8 years prior to that. All of my cooking experience has been in vegetarian and vegan kitchens. The 8.5 years prior to that, I worked for a vegetarian restaurant, and it sort of happened naturally. I was meeting a lot of people who were vegetarian and vegan, and working with people who were vegan. And they had very convincing arguments for why vegan was a smart way to go. One, you know, of course, there are the natural reasons that we talk about. For some, it was spirituality. For some, it's the environment, health, and then the health of the animals as well. And some of those resonated for me. And it seemed like the smart thing to do. And it just, and again, I was cooking this way even before I was eating this way. So eventually the cooking won out, and there I was. So anyway, over the course of the first 2 or 3 years of owning my own bakery, I gained 200 pounds, and I did it eating not only a vegan diet, but a vegan diet that was full of processed foods. So as I heard you mention earlier, lots of oil, white flour, processed sugars, and the like. And it was very easy, and it had happened really without my paying much attention to it.
Enjoying every bite, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, I'm a good baker. I hate to say it, but a good baker. So I spent the next 4 or 5 years, close to 500 pounds.
Whoa.
And it wasn't until I fell one day and twisted an ankle and tore a tendon in my foot that I had a wake-up call. And in 2005, I actually came to the Wellness Forum as a client because nothing I was doing was working. I wasn't exercising because my foot hurt. I was working all the time. I was still eating. I closed the bakery actually by this time and opened a meal delivery service, but it was still a lot of oil and a lot more of the processed foods. And I went to the Wellness Forum and said, I need some help. And I became a client and became a member and adopted a low-fat, plant-based diet and spent the next several years regaining my health, which I am still doing. I've lost over 200 pounds.
Good for you.
And I am a much better, much happier, much healthier person today than I was 6 years ago. So I'm very happy.
Well, I think we're all on a path when it comes to vegan and vegetarian diets. Actually, I think all of our culture is on a path where we're learning about health and nutrition. We didn't know much about health and nutrition with regard to food over 100 years ago, and it's just all starting to come out where we're discovering what the nutrients are in food and what they can do for us. So it's all new. Some people kind of romanticize and fantasize about going back to the way things were, and I don't know that that's entirely ideal because we really didn't know what the right foods were to eat back then.
And actually, I won't disagree with you. I agree in a lot of ways. I think that we have a fantasy of what the way things were.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a reality that's out there, too, and we see that in populations who still eat the way that our ancestors really ate. In other words, if you go back 200 years or 300 years in civilizations around the world, you'll see plenty of populations who do not have processed foods in their diet. They don't have oils, and they don't have sugar and white flour, and they don't have potato chips, and they don't have those kinds of foods. Not only that, they don't have a lot of meat in their diet because they can't afford it. It's expensive.
Right.
So they eat a low-fat, whole foods, plant-based diet that's based on, primarily on starches like potatoes and beans and grains and vegetables. And then the rest of it comes just sort of as condiments. They eat meat when they can afford it, but you don't see 32-ounce steaks on a plate. You know, so that's the way that we really ate, and there's a lot of science that shows that, and the China study shows it, and we can look at populations around the world that don't have our health conditions that show it as well. So it's this fantasy versus the reality of the way that our lives used to be that we want. You know, but even my grandparents ate less processed foods than I did.
Oh, sure. It all started really big time about 50, well, right after World War II is when mm-hmm. we really had the chemical explosion with pesticides and herbicides, and then the manufacturing, the industrialization, the food system totally changed.
Right.
Yeah. Okay,
right.
So we're getting back to where we belong, and fortunately, more and more people are getting on this path, and we have the whole forks over knives package,
mm-hmm.
and now we have 300 recipes to try. let's jump into the cookbook. You've got everything in here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the goal is that you can start with breakfast and go through dinner and even have an occasional dessert as a treat.
I talk a lot about not using oil and salt. When we cook at home, we rarely use oil. I will admit, occasionally I do use oil in food, but it's really a rare event, and and I rarely use salt as well. And you've probably seen this, but people's reaction to that, what? No oil? What? No salt? They just don't know and can't imagine. And yet, I mean, for example, you talk about a lot of things in here. I'm looking, for example, at the nitta kibbeh recipe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to saute onions and caramelize them and have them be loaded with flavor without oil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I spent, when I came to the Wellness Forum, my co-partner, my business partner said to me, get rid of the oil from your foods. And I spent 2 or 3 weeks in my own kitchen going, how the heck does that happen? But once I figured it out and developed the technique for doing it, it's the easiest thing you've ever seen, whether it's sautéing and caramelizing onions or whether it's I'm doing a stir-fry. I mean, you know, we think of stir-fries as definitely needing oil because every time we go to a Chinese restaurant, it's loaded with oil. But you can do stir-fries, and there are several recipes in the book that show you oil-free stir-fries that are full of flavor.
That's right. Now, the other thing people are confused about is when you talk about not eating oil, they equate that to fat.
Right.
And we need fat.
Right. We need some fat. We don't need a lot. And I know that the USDA recommendations are higher than you'll hear us talk about, and especially the experts talk about forks over knives. But there's a difference between getting your fat from oil and getting it from a whole food. And then the biggest difference is we've removed the fiber, and we've removed most of the nutrients from our fat, so that when we buy oils, we're buying oils that have had the nutrients added back in. And let me tell you that the humans are never as good at putting nutrients into food as nature is.
No, we're not, because we don't know what all of those nutrients are.
We barely begin to identify the micronutrients in our food. But, you know, nature has done a really good job of it, and we need to let nature run its course with our food and get back to eating that way. So there are plenty of ways to get fat, the little fat that you need from flaxseed is one of the ways that I get mine, a few nuts and seeds, and I talk about this all the time when I teach my cooking classes. There's a difference between garnishing a dish with a couple of tablespoons full of cashews and then eating a jar of cashews.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Americans tend to do is we, and I've been that person. We tend to go all out with our consumption. So it's okay to have nuts and seeds because they're healthy nuts and seeds. Well, they're healthy in the right quantities.
Well, what's great about them when you garnish a meal or a dish with it is that it brings out all the flavor. And so you get these lovely taste sensations, these tickles of wonderful flavors, and the nuts
right.
and seeds will do that.
Oh, yeah.
They can
yeah.
perk up a salad or any kind of dish.
It doesn't take much.
Doesn't take much, yeah.
Yeah. If you find yourself eating a whole jar of cashews, then you really got to look at why it is you're doing that and start to ask that kind of a question. If you can eat just that garnish on a salad or something, you're eating more in balance. And anything else, there's a question that you've got to be asking yourself about why you're doing that.
So the other thing is a lot of creamy sauces are used in restaurants or in French food, and I'm looking right across the page from the Nitter Kibbeh. I mean, I haven't even barely gotten into the book here yet, but I'm stuck on one page. The cauliflower bechamel, I think it's really an important concept because it gives you the look, the feel, almost a mouth feel of a really creamy sauce. It has a lot of flavor. And when you blend things up together, you don't know what's in them. You just
have
flavor.
Right. You can fool the mouth, if you will, in a lot of different ways. And I tell you, the idea for that cauliflower bechamel came from a soup that I used to make, which is a roasted cauliflower bisque. And it had the original recipe had oil in it. But even taking the oil out of that, when I would make that soup and puree it, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is so – and everyone loves that soup. But it took on the flavor, as do a lot of foods. It took on the flavor of whatever I did with it. So I used that sauce in a curried pasta sauce. You can use it in a traditional bechamel sauce as a topping for lasagna and a white sauce. There are so many, anywhere that you can use a traditional bechamel, you can use this sauce, and that's what makes it exciting. But the cool part is if you, especially if you're doing what I call health by deception at home, is you're putting another serving of vegetables into the mouths of those that you feed, and they don't have to know it.
Right, especially children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they, well, children and probably my father, when he sees something like a speck of green or something, he'll usually say, "What's that?" And it's just so much easier to blend it all up and make it taste good. It's white sauce.
I highly suggest it with family members who are a little bit hesitant to change the way that they think about food. Is be deceptive about it. You're doing it in a loving and caring way, and that's okay.
That's right. Okay, one of my favorite ingredients. You've got a bunch of recipes for fava beans, and I never see them in anything.
Well, we tend to, and Americans, you know, we eat an average of 6 to 10 different food items a day. We're not very good about variety in our foods. And so one of the goals with this cookbook was to make sure that there were a lot of different kinds of foods in there for people to sort of try and to expand their horizons with. And I love fava beans, and I've had a Middle Eastern restaurant. I have two of them near my house. So Columbus is a great city for Middle Eastern food, and one of them has an amazing fava bean dip, which is pretty similar to hummus. Mm-hmm. Now, it has a lot of oil in it, but the oil isn't what gives it the flavor. Mm-hmm. The fava beans themselves are delicious.
Fava beans, garlic, lemon, period.
Ah, yeah.
So good.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
It's delicious. So I had to include some recipes in there because it's one of my favorite beans.
They're not that easy to find, but if you look, they're there.
And I think if you really want to be a food explorer, if you live in a small town where you're not going to find fava beans, I think that there are great places online to order food now. We've changed the way that we can buy our food, and there are some good options out there. So don't let that stop you from. And I have to say, because I mean I hear this criticism a little bit from time to time, is that fava beans are definitely one kind of bean that you'll find in the book, but there are plenty of beans that you'll find in your regular grocery store too. And that's important. So most of the food in this book, you can make it by shopping at traditional grocery stores.
The other thing I like is I started my vegetarian path a long time ago, and I used to enjoy going to Indian food restaurants a lot because there were a lot of options, lots of flavor. And I've been going to Indian restaurants less and less because it's oil and salt.
Yeah.
But you've got some great recipes in here that are the traditional dishes that have all the right seasonings and vegetables without the oil and salt.
Without that oil. And I've been eating Indian food. My first vegetarian experience from one of my closest friends, I've known her for 30-some years, and she lived in India for several years, and she cooks a delicious Indian meal. Now, she even, at this point in time, does not use oil in her food. Mm. But I learned the flavorings a lot from her, as well as my own love of Indian food. And again, Columbus is Indian food's another thing that you can find in abundance here.
What's the climate like in Columbus, Ohio, in terms of health?
Well, Columbus is kind of the test market for the country for a lot of things. So fast food is abundant here, and there's plenty of fast food options, and there's plenty of unhealthy foods here. But it's changing as it is everywhere. The Wellness Forum has been here for 15 years. We have several hundred members of our program have gone through our program here. Several thousand have gone through our program, even locally. So there's awareness of health, but, it's like it is a lot of places. There's still some reticence to change our ways and to see new ways of thinking. So we've had, and I've worked at, again, some of the vegetarian and vegan restaurants in town. There are still vegetarian and vegan options, and most restaurants now offer vegan options, so you can go in, and even if it's not on the menu, talk to a chef or talk to a waiter and say, what can you do for me? And when you say vegan, people know what it means.
Yeah, isn't
now,
that nice?
Yeah. Yeah, that's not always been the case. The harder part is the oil-free thinking. And it's getting better, but you still have to say, no oil. And I hate to say it, but again, it's that health by deception. It's sometimes saying, look, I have a cardiovascular condition. I'm really trying to be careful with my heart here. So if you can just steam my vegetables. And I always tell people the thing to do is to call ahead. Call a restaurant and say, I'm coming in, and here's how I eat. What can you fix for me? And a lot of chefs love to do something special for things like that. So the climate's changing, as it is everywhere, but, we're a big, there's a lot of health industry here. Cardinal Health and Ohio Health and all of those are all here. So when you go to health fairs, you still get some of the traditional screenings and people telling you that eat heart-healthy oils, and it drives you crazy, but, what do you do?
Yep. You just keep on keeping on.
Keep on.
Okay, so the Wellness Forum, the website is wellnessforum.com.
Right.
And what is it?
Well, the Wellness Forum has been helping people to improve, in other words, to achieve optimal health, to reverse degenerative diseases for 15 years. The program is based, and the diet that we teach is very, very much like you'll see in the China study and programs like Dr. John McDougall's, Dr. Cole Wilson. So it's a low-fat, whole foods, plant-based diet, but we teach people through a 10-hour course how to eat, how the importance of exercise and proper hydration, of stress reduction. And we offer, I think what makes our program different from a lot of programs that you'll find like ours is that you become a member for a year. And over the course of that year, we offer ongoing support. So we have a monthly call that you can do with both Dr. Popper, the founder, and myself. And her call is going to be on a different health topic. And then it goes to a Q&A format. And mine's the same way with cooking. So we spend 10 minutes talking about fall fruits and vegetables, and the rest of the hour answering your general questions on cooking. We have cooking classes once a month. We bring in guest speakers. We have an annual conference, all with the goal of mine. And then we have a members-only portion of our website where you can find a lot of archived information. So all with the goal of being able to say, you can do this course and go off on your own and do it really well. But for a lot of people, it's nice to get that ongoing support that helps you to stay in tune and stay on track.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a friend that's trying again to go vegan, and he called me to let me know what he ate last night at a Mexican restaurant. He was at a party, and he had the power. He foregoed the cheese and the sour cream. But just for somebody to say, good for you, you're on the right track.
Right.
People really need that support.
Well, and you have to remember that a lot of people go home to what I call sort of a hostile environment where nobody else wants to eat that way.
Yeah.
So that's hard to deal with every day and every night to know that you're the only one that thinks the way that you do. So having a place that you can go to, and we have people that come to we have a monthly dinner that people come to, the different events and the calls and things like that, and being able to talk with like-minded people really, really helps people a lot.
Let's get back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which was your story. And my partner, he had a similar path when he was young. He was always overweight, and his mom was putting him on all kinds of crazy diets, the egg and grapefruit diet and all kinds of stuff. Oh, you know that one?
not the egg and grapefruit. I went on the grapefruit diet.
And it wasn't until he came to this vegan lifestyle that he finally made peace with his food, which is what he talks about. He even did this was before he went vegan, but he did this 7th month performance piece called Eating Disorder, Eating Dad Order, when he talked about all these different diets that he had been on. But how do you feel now with what you're eating in terms of, how do you feel about your food?
Well, and I tell you what, part of making changes to eating a different way is dealing with some of the reasons why we eat. So, in other words, we can teach you how to eat and what to eat. But that doesn't necessarily, and I've been dealing with this in the past couple of years, and I'm having some great success with that, is dealing with some of the triggers for why I eat bad foods. And now for me, bad foods have changed. Bad food used to be meat and cheese and blah, 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 and now bad food might be potato chips and some of those processed foods. So I don't fight myself with food the way that I used to. Like, I really sort of look forward to eating, and I cook really good food, so I'm a really lucky person.
Right.
You know.
Well, that could be lucky, and that could also go against you. When
it
you can't cook, you can make anything you want, and then you're in danger.
Right. Right. But again, in having those conversations about choosing a healthier path, I have to look beyond an individual meal to the goals that I'm trying to achieve. So I still have, you know, 20, 25, 30, 30 pounds to lose, or whatever that is, and I still have the rest of my life to live, which means I don't want cardiovascular disease, I don't want diabetes, or any of those other degenerative diseases. I don't want medication to be my course of life and living my life in doctor's offices. So I have to make choices that help me to achieve that goal. Okay, and so that's part of what drives my eating decisions every day. Now, one of the things that I do is I sanitize my house. So you won't go into my house and find potato chips and oil and sugar and white flour and any of those things that would tempt me. And someone being a baker, the flour especially is an easy one. I can have pancakes in 10 minutes. So you don't find those things that tempt me. I have to leave the house to go get them if I want them. And that allows me time to have that conversation with myself.
Right.
You know, if I'm going to get into a car at 10 o'clock at night and go get even vegan ice cream, there's plenty of time to talk myself out of it and have a conversation about what it is I'm actually doing here.
Yeah, it's really important to buy only the healthy food in your house. And that can be a challenge when you're living with other people who aren't in line with what you're doing.
Yeah, I don't know that I could do this if I had to live in a house where there were cookies and potato chips and that kind of food. It'd be really hard for me.
But I make some pancakes that are healthy. My pancakes are just like a bowl of oatmeal all whored up and cooked.
Well, I think what you have to do is distinguish. I'm not saying that I would never, ever eat pancakes. I'm saying that to have them available all the time is not a smart thing for me.
Yeah.
So when I choose to have them, that's one thing.
Right.
If I have company coming over and we're going to have Sunday brunch, then I might have pancakes or I might have a scone. But I don't make that something that's available for me every day.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that that we've kind of fallen out of, and making special food, food that's a treat, food that's a luxury.
We want the treat all the time.
Yeah.
That's where we've gotten to, and I think that's what we have to get away from.
So do you have a comfort food that you like to go to that's within the regimen?
I do. I love pasta. Mm-hmm. And I make a pasta stir fry that's very healthy. But you know, when you're trying to lose weight, pasta it can be a healthy food, but it's a very concentrated calorie. So the difference between a cup of grain, like a whole grain, like a wheat berry, is some less than 100 calories, or around 100 calories, where a cup of flour has 400 calories. So it's that caloric density that I sort of balance out in my life. But every now and then, you know, a nice stir fry pasta dish makes me very, very happy.
Okay, well, let's just underline in these last few minutes. It's the importance of what we've been talking about. We're talking about food that's delicious, food that's good for you. But the thing is, most Americans today, over 600,000 a year die from cardiovascular disease. It's reversible. It's preventable. A lot of great work by Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn shows that in his book, Prevent Heart Disease.
Mm-hmm.
We know this now. And we need to be doing more about it. And so this is definitely a good step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'd like to see some scared straight programs where we show people what they go through when they have cardiovascular disease and having your chest ripped open to have a stent put in there and what that's like. I mean, I have a friend that just had a heart replacement done, and he says the pain was the most unbearable thing you can ever imagine for months.
Well, it's just interesting what people think of as extreme. People will say eating plants is extreme, but cracking your sternum open is normal.
Yeah, that's a normal thing. Yeah, that amazes me, that conversation all the time. You'd rather spend your life navigating doctor's office visits, navigating the nine medications that you're on, each one a response to the side effects of another, and feeling like crap all the time.
Yeah.
I have energy that I've not had most of my life.
That's amazing, isn't it?
I look forward to that every day.
Yeah. Well, Del, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Thanks for creating this very heavy book. I look forward to carrying it around the rest of the day.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And wellnessforum.com, that's where we find you and all that you do.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Thanks
thank you so much. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. We're going to take a very quick break. In the meanwhile, you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where I live. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about sustainable biodynamic farming with Sebastiano Cosia Castiglioni. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, because you know what? It is all about food. Everything that you can think of, I think, is related to food. Our health, the environment, animals, all life on Earth. It's connected to the food we eat and what we're doing to get food in our mouths. And every time we sit down at the table, we really should be thinking, at least for a moment, where that food came from and the incredible path it took to get to the point where it's on our plate and we get to enjoy it. Something a lot of us take for granted. Okay, so I want to bring on my next guest, Sebastiano Cosia Castiglioni. And he was born in Milan, Italy in 1966. He has been a vegetarian and an animal rights activist for nearly 30 years. He's the owner and chairman of one of the most renowned and pioneering wineries in Europe, Quercciabella, where organic viticulture implemented in 1988 led to a complete conversion to strict biodynamic practices in 2000. His Tuscan wines have garnered worldwide acclaim, including Best Italian Wine in 2004. Sebastiano is an industrial designer and the creator of a multinational business network encompassing fields as varied as agriculture, financial advisory, advanced technology, and real estate. He currently lives with his family in Northern Europe. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad I got to meet you last week and to coordinate it so that you could come into the Manhattan studio, because you're not always here. And
absolutely. And it's a pleasure to touch on the subjects that you often talk about. I'm convinced that really it is all about food. And we need to start asking ourselves some serious questions. And that's what we did when we started figuring out a different way to produce wine. And not only we approached it from the organic standpoint, which I think is a must nowadays. I mean, how else can we think to do anything responsibly and sustainably and in a healthy way if not going the organic way? But as you know, we also share a passion for animals and for their well-being. And so I thought about how to create an agricultural complex, a farm, that would work without ever using any animal-based product. And it is possible. Mm-hmm. We're doing it. We have been doing it for years now. And now the question is, I don't know if you want me to explain a little bit about biodynamics.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Not too many know. We all know more or less what organic is. You take away all the harmful chemical products and get rid of them. With biodynamics, you take a much wider approach, and you're actually very proactive. So what you're trying to do is to bring nature back into agriculture. So you're trying to reestablish an ecosystem where nature does what it normally does, what it does best. And so there are lots of techniques that we use. Most importantly, cover crops. Cover crops are these plants that you plant among the ones that you're growing for food. And so in vineyards, for instance, we plant every year, we plant every other row with this wonderful mix of flowers and aromatic herbs, legumes, and you name it. It's 32 to 36 different plants, depending on the period, on the area.
Do you use those legumes and herbs?
Because the way you use it in biodynamics is you plant them between rows, and when they come into, when they bloom, when they come into flower, you cut them and mix them into the soil.
Hmm.
And this brings so many nutrients back to the soil. You might be familiar with the fact that legumes, for instance, extract certain substances and give back nitrogen to the soil. Mm-hmm. And so what you do with this process is, first of all, these plants have a fantastic influence on everything around them while they're growing and they're in flower. So, for instance, at our winery, Querchabella, we have a fantastic population of bees that we support by planting tons of organic flowers all year round. And by the way, I'd love to say that these bees produce a ton of honey, which we do not harvest. We only take what's in excess and bothers them. Actually, it's a very long story, and Jane, my wife Jane, is the one who deals with all of this, and she's the mastermind behind all the work on the bees. But anyway, there are certain ways to build beehives that are more natural to the bees, where they live happier, and believe it or not, they produce exactly what they need and very little extra. So, you know, all we take is what bothers them when they need to move around, but we leave them all their honey, which they need in the winter. Anyway, back to the cover crops, they have fantastic functions. For instance, there are plants like mustard that repel funguses, and there are plants that attract certain insects that are beneficial. There are other plants that repel other insects that you don't want to have around because they're damaging to the grapes. And so there's this fantastic balance, and there are scientific studies that show that where you have cover crops, you have 20 times more animal species around than you have where you don't. And so imagine...
Now is that might be good for nature, but does that affect the grapes at all in a negative way?
Well, it does in many ways. First of all, the vine is a vine, as the word says. So, yes, it's normally, hardnessed into, a system where it grows in this and that. But if you let it grow more freely, it will actually produce much better grapes and a better fruit. And so this environment that has lots of insects and birds and where the soil is fantastic, imagine that the goal is to obtain a soil that is very similar to what you find in a forest, to humus in a forest. So it's very soft, it's humid. In some of our vineyards, you can stick your arm into the soil, and it goes all the way to the elbow. Mm. It's so soft. Mm-hmm. So imagine this environment that is very conducive to nature being in balance with itself and the fruit that you obtain. We all know the difference between the flavor of a conventional carrot and an organic carrot, and it's shocking. The difference is shocking. Now, imagine a fruit that not only is organic, but has lived in an environment that is as natural as it gets, with all the flora and fauna and the insects and the microorganisms that are supposed to be there, and they normally are not because they're all killed. And so Biodynamics tries to recreate this balance and this beautiful ecosystem where life is abundant and beautiful. And
I can't believe that that's not going to add to the flavor.
Well, what happens is, technically speaking, the roots go much deeper. There's no irrigation in Biodynamics, and, of course, no fertilizers. And, of course, we do not use manure because that's against our principles. So what the vines do is they grow these roots that go very deep down. They go 45, sometimes 60 feet underground.
Wow.
So their nourishment comes from very deep in the soil and comes from this beautiful soil. So they, of course, there's some nourishment from the surface, from this very soft soil that I described, but there's also nourishment from deep down. And so what you get is a wine fruit, and therefore a wine that is very mineral, is very rich in deep flavors, it reflects much more the character of the place where it grows.
You mentioned that there's no irrigation use.
Yes.
I remember maybe 5 years ago or something, France didn't use irrigation, and then they made it legal to irrigate in their vineyards.
Yes.
Which is kind of, I guess...
Well, in France, actually, they have irrigated for a longer time, but they usually irrigated only when the vineyards were, when the wines were very small and this and that. There are always excuses to use irrigation. But just imagine a vine that is nourished from the surface with horrible petroleum-based fertilizers, and the roots turn upwards, and, you know, everything is dead, basically, because the soil is absolutely dead. And the difference is a soil that is completely alive. you look at our soil and you see insects going all over the place and birds flying around. The birds tend to nest all around these places and these plants because, of course, they eat the insects. And I mean, the whole cycle is beautiful. And that's a fundamental difference. The interesting part is, as it often happens to those who do things differently, we get criticized all the time. And the funniest thing is I have people coming up to me and saying, but is there any scientific basis to biodynamics? And they say, well, let's assume for a second that there's no basis for what we do. There are hundreds of scientific studies that show that conventional agriculture is dangerous, harmful, and damaging to the world, to people, to animals, and to everybody else. So just because of that, I think it makes sense to explore alternative venues. Then there are people who say it cannot work because, you know, when then you have sicknesses and you have this and you have the weather and this and that. Well, guess what? We've been organic since 1988. Not a single molecule of chemical product has been sprayed on our vineyards since then, and we're doing great. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many times we do better than our neighbors who spray all the time.
Does that affect you at all, that your neighbors around you are spraying?
Well, actually, I'm talking about the neighbors, but we luckily have very few neighbors. In fact, most of our vineyards are surrounded by forests, luckily, and we border with only one guy in one specific spot, and we are working very hard to convince him not to spray in every possible way, but it's a microscopic contact. For the rest, we're very protective. But what I meant by neighbors, I meant other people in Tuscany or in the region of Chianti Classico who, you know, grow vines in a conventional way.
It's frustrating what people will believe without really being knowledgeable. So this is kind of an analogy, but last week I was talking with Brian Clement, who works at the Hippocrates Institute, and he just put out a book called Food is Medicine, and I really didn't understand the point of the book because all it is lists of studies that have been done with a brief description of the results on all of these different foods and how they affect health. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can go on the internet and, you know, find this out, stuff out. But he said he goes to these conferences where doctors and nutritionists say, oh, you know, I don't believe, you know, what work has been done showing plants are healthier, and now he has, here it is, here's the book.
And it is very important.
You need like something like, here it
Absolutely.
Is, here's all the organic vineyards, biodynamic vineyards that are doing it,
Absolutely.
And here's all the studies that show chemical pesticides are dangerous. And
you bet. And, you know, the greatest demonstration is opening a bottle, drinking the wine, tasting it, and wow, it's great. And we as you mentioned, we won the award for best Italian wine. It can be done. You know, it certainly can be done. And paraphrasing my friend Elon Musk, the creator of the Tesla and many other things, he says, I don't want to hear complaints from losers. All I want to hear is ideas from people who actually do things.
Right.
I'm tired to listen to people who sit there, criticize, and don't do anything.
Well, that's a problem in this country, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Well, it's a problem everywhere.
But the biodynamic thing, I was talking to somebody about it recently, and he kind of rolled his eyes because he thought about the woo-woo-wah-wah stuff that's associated with biodynamics. So what part of it, I imagine there's a range of what biodynamics is because
Absolutely.
There really isn't an official...
The way it is biodynamics is based on these conferences that Rudolf Steiner held at the beginning of the 20th century. And then one part of biodynamics, this group decided to codify everything he said and establish these very strict rules. But what Steiner actually said is, these are my ideas. You have to adapt them to your environment and dynamically transform them to better your environment. The main concept is create an ecosystem that is in balance with the rest of the planet.
Work with nature, not
against it. Work with nature and not against it. So now there are the biodynamic zealots who say that you have to do it this way and not that way, and if you change an iota, it's not the real thing. And then there are people like us who adapt it and actually go much further than the original, you know, ideas or the codified ideas. So, for instance, we have banned all animal-based products. You may have heard of the biodynamic thing, the cow horn that's mm-hmm. filled with manure and it's buried underground, and then blah, 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 blah. Well, there are very useful things there, and I could go into that, but the point is you don't really need a cow horn, and you don't need, you know, cow intestines to transform other products that then you spray on your vineyards. You can do it all plant-based, and it mm-hmm. can be done. It's done not only by us. There's a very famous woman called Maria Thun who has codified the biodynamic calendar, and she publishes every year the calendar that we all follow about, you know, that instructs you about the best time to plant and to harvest and this and that. But it can be done. It can be done. And regarding the, you know, the esoteric image of biodynamics, I concur. I think, in general, the perception and the substance in many cases is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
and what, you know, I am an atheist. I despise astrology. I have no time whatsoever for any new wave nonsense. So I'm completely separate from all the woo-woo surrounding biodynamics. And in fact, I'm more interested in scientific evidence that is mounting and it's growing about the positive effects of biodynamics and the way nature and plants interact. For instance, there's this fantastic scientist called Peter Barlow in England who's been collecting information about something very important. We know that our ancestors for thousands of years relied on moon phases to decide when to work in the fields. And only during the 20th century it's been considered a superstition, but it makes complete sense. And these studies by Peter Barlow show that the strongest force in the life of plant is the interaction between the moon and the sun and the gravitational forces they create. So we all know that plants live by the sun, that they point towards light, and the temperature influences their life. But guess what? If you put plants inside a closed box with no temperature change and no light, they will still move every few hours. And no one could explain why they were moving until Peter Barlow figured out that it was the exact coincidence with gravitational phases of the moon. So this force is so strong, as we can see with the ocean tides, that it influences the life of plants completely. Now, we don't have a manual that says exactly, you know, if the moon is like this, this is what you have to do. But what we're doing is we're trying to learn and listen and try and empirically establish what works best. And believe me, there are huge differences. The most basic experiment being plant during a certain phase and see how much it grows, planted during another and see that it grows three times as fast. And,
wow.
You know, who can explain that?
But, well, you know, we think we're so smart, and we have so much to learn.
Absolutely.
And just by paying attention, we might learn a lot more. I just know as humans, a lot of us are affected by the phase of the moon just in terms of our moods.
Absolutely.
And there's evidence of that. So there's a lot of magic out there that
Absolutely.
We haven't quite figured out that really isn't magical. It just
Absolutely.
Looks like it is.
And especially, you know, for thousands of years, people have used certain techniques. They must make sense. I mean, it can't be that throughout the world, you know, lunar phases were followed in places as varied as Latin America, Australia, and Europe when they had no contact with each other. It's,
right.
you know, how could that be? Obviously.
Have you heard of veganic agriculture?
Yes. Yes, I have.
So maybe what you're doing is I'm like trying to come up with another name, biodynamic or bio-veganic.
The way we call it is cruelty-free biodynamics. I like that because I focus on this mostly because I care about the animals. So I want to emphasize the fact that the alternatives require cruelty. We all know that there's no sustainable way to farm animals, to grow animals in a farm, no matter what kind of model is put in front of our eyes. And we all know that raising animals for any purpose in agriculture means suffering and pain to them. And so I want to focus on the fact that cruelty is part of that model, and I'm against it, and I want to do without it.
Well, I love that you're doing without it. And there are some that believe you need animal manure, and they use that to justify having animals. But then I think, okay, so have a few cows and chickens. You don't have to kill them. Why don't you just let them hang out?
But then again, we are the demonstration that you do not need manure.
Exactly.
You can use green manure. Not only we grow grapes, but we now have, I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you, but we now grow all of our grains and all of our legumes and all of the plants and all of the flowers, the herbal, the herbs that we need for our preparations. And we grow everything ourselves in biodynamic fields without a molecule of manure. Manure is not necessary. In fact, plants are much happier when you feed them with plants. Think about a forest. Yes, okay, there's the occasional animal who dies in the middle of a forest that nourishes the soil there. But mostly what is it fed by? It's leaves and other plants that die. Mm-hmm. It's so natural. And that's where you find, guess what, the most wonderful soil, and if you imagine your ideal soil is the one that grows at the bottom of a forest. So that's the ideal soil if you wanted to do the most wonderful agriculture in the world. So why go and reinvent everything and bring animals into the picture when they don't belong? I mean, they belong free, happy, alive, and flying around and playing. We have a population of rabbits that is incredible, and we have all the most beautiful animals you can imagine. But they're happy, they eat the plants there, and that's it.
I'm just curious, how did you get started being an animal rights activist and getting into biodynamic agriculture?
I was 15 years old, and by chance I saw some literature about vivisection, and so I became engaged in that. And of course, once you see that, you cannot eat meat anymore, and so I became a vegetarian overnight.
Well, some people can, unfortunately.
Well, I couldn't. It didn't make sense to me to say, oh, I don't want animals to suffer and experience, but I'm going to have them slaughtered and killed and tortured for my food. So I just made the decision, and overnight I became a vegetarian, and now I'm vegan. I'm vegetarian every once in a while socially when I can't avoid it because I travel a lot for work. And in some countries, the word vegan has not even appeared in the dictionary yet. But I certainly am involved in animal rights activism, and I have been since then. And I'm honored to be on the advisory board of Sea Shepherd. And I would like to take a chance, if you'd let me, to send a heartfelt hug to Paul Watson,
wherever you are.
Dear Paul, we're with you. And I think it all goes together.
Well, the message that I really like to give is that we can eat delicious food, we can drink wonderful tasting wines, and we can do it in balance with nature. Now, some people may believe that you can't produce enough food or enough wine by growing in this way.
It's quite the opposite. We have fantastic fertile soil, and there are thousands of scientific studies that show that organic and biodynamic soil is more fertile, and especially that it's going to be fertile forever, whereas conventional soil might be overnourished for a while, and then it dies and it becomes desert. So it's the opposite of what. So for one fertile acre of conventional soil, you know that thousands are going to die, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for making wine. We're not drinking anything else anymore, just Corchivella.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Where can people learn more about your wine?
Oh, we have a website, Corchivella.com. So Q-U-E-R-C-I-A-B-E-L-L-A.com. And our wine is sold throughout the U.S. It's actually, the United States, our number one market. So.
And I noticed you're on Barnivore.com.
Absolutely.
Which is where we find out all our vegan wines and alcoholic beverages.
You bet. We're there.
Great.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Please visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me a note at info@realmeals.org. And don't forget, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.